From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith. Thanks for joining us. Last month, the New Hanover County School Board got a presentation from historian Rebecca Taylor about a potential addition to the history curriculum. The story of the Freeman family and their land in the southern part of the county, including Seabreeze, which has long been a safe haven for people of color. Descendants of the Freeman family were happy to hear their story would be taught, but they hope it's done the right way. The story mainly starts in the mid-19th century with Alexander and Charity Freeman, who were free people of color. They left their son, Robert Bruce, 108 acres of land. Bruce then amassed nearly 3,000 acres, which he passed on to his 11 children. But what happened to the Freeman's land after Bruce's death is complicated. Some of it was lost in the heir process. Large portions were taken by eminent domain, and recently the town of Carolina Beach bought some of the remaining portions of land at Freeman Park and has officially designated it a public space. A historical marker was also put up to commemorate the Freemans and their accomplishments in May, and descendants Christopher Eaton and Dorian Cromartie are proud of getting that done. Christopher Eaton is a Freeman descendant, and his grandfather is civil rights icon Dr. Hubert Eaton. Dorian Cromartie, who ran for the New Hanover County School Board in 2022, is the grandson of Rachel Freeman. She was a member of the school board and an advocate for education. One of the elementary schools is named after her. Christopher and Dorian, thanks for being here. Let's start with the story of Alexander and Charity Freeman. Who were they, Christopher?
Alexander and Charity Freeman were the parents of Robert Bruce Freeman Sr., and they did migrate from Bladen, Columbus County area to the lower Black River district of New Hanover County. And I believe the earliest census records of that was in 1840. And then from 1840 to 1850, they moved even further south from the lower Black River district to Federal Point. In the 1850 census, Alexander and Charity were listed as free persons of color in the Federal Point Township, along with Robert Bruce Freeman and another brother, Frank.
And what was the designation next to them? Was it for their ethnicity?
Mulatto.
Okay, that's how they were described. Mm-hmm. Did they identify as Native Americans or Black, or do we know that?
The best guess that I could come up with, they identified as Native American, because that's what Alexander and Charity were.
What did they do, and then how did they start amassing this land?
Alexander was listed as a fisherman. In 1855, Alexander purchased 108 acres on Myrtle Grove Sound from Thomas Joyner, and that is the original Freeman tract, which was actually, I don't want to guess the mileage, but it's further up the road from what we know now as Seabreeze, kind of like where Myrtle Grove Road is.
And so he earned enough as a fisherman to buy that land at the time?
Yes. And I'm assuming he had help from others.
In his family?
In his family, or he seemed to have made friends with some of the right people. I'm not sure what he did for those people, but he could not read or write.
And how do we know that?
By the wordage of his will, and when it went to probate, it states, I believe, a gentleman named William Reston, who was an attorney. He was the one who drafted Alexander's will. He left everything to his son, Robert Bruce Freeman Sr.
Okay, because he was the oldest.
Yes, he was the eldest. And it was 108 acres. I've tried to do my research about Charity. There's not a lot of information on Charity. I do know that Robert Bruce Freeman Sr. had at least one sister, older sister, that I know for a fact lived here in New Hanover County in downtown Wilmington. Her name was Jane B. Green.
And what did Robert Bruce do?
Robert Bruce was a laborer, fisherman, kind of a jack of all trades, really.
And that is how he was able to continue to buy land because, again, he was working and just buying up land when he could.
Yes.
And at the time of his death, how much land did he have?
At the time of his death in 1901, he owned little under 3,000 acres.
Just throughout his life, purchasing year by year?
No. He owned the original 108 acres that his father Alexander left him at the time of his death. In 1870, he purchased 320-acre tract known as the Fergus Tract. That tract was connected to Caintuck Landing and Lord's Creek, so kind of in the general vicinity of the original 108-acre tract.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only tract that I have not been able to find accurate meets and bounds descriptions, but I believe I know exactly where it is. In 1876, he purchased 2,500 acres of land for $1 an acre.
He did leave his 11 children a large mass of land, and we'll talk about that, how that was divided up and how complicated that was. But
yeah. I think it's interesting that he was able to accomplish what he accomplished also without the ability to read and write.
Robert Bruce?
Yes.
And we know that through, were other professionals drafting his documents and things like that as well?
Yes. His signature is not consistent, and it always says his mark. So from what I was told, that's typical of somebody drafting it in his name, and possibly one of his sons drafted his will for him. And I do know it's kind of ironic, but are you familiar with Captain John Harper?
No.
Okay. He's one of the instrumental players in the development of the town of Carolina Beach and the New Hanover County Transit Company. He was the steamer captain that used to dock down here at Market Street and transport visitors of all color down to Carolina Beach along the river. And that's where they built the transit car system on the Cape Fear Riverside. And they would disembark from the steamer and get on a train or a trolley and go to Carolina Beach after it was developed. Captain John Harper was a witness to Robert Bruce Freeman Sr.'s will. Every signing, every coincile, he was very close with Robert Bruce.
And he was a person of color too, or?
No, he was a
white man.
Yes.
And so they were close.
Yes.
So he helped facilitate a lot of this.
I believe that the family trusted him.
Okay.
To have their best interest in heart.
So with the will, wasn't there confusion, though, with the way that it was drafted and how it was divided up between his children, though?
You could say it was confusion, but it left out a large portion of his land holdings, of what specific heir was going to receive which parcel. And essentially, his will just kind of divided one tract, a 400-acre tract known as the Old Homestead, into seven tracts. And the first six tracts went to his sons or surviving heirs of his first wife, to Catherine Ann Davis Freeman. And tract seven went to his second wife, Lena Freeman. And all the children that he had with Lena Freeman after Catherine passed in 1885, they had to share that one tract, tract seven, to share and share alike.
And I think historian Rebecca Taylor said at this presentation in July to the school board that there was a commission to figure out who got what. Is that right? Or
yes.
Yeah.
In 1914, there was a committee established, and it stipulated exactly, gave meets and bounds descriptions of where track one began and ended, track two began and ended, and so on and so forth, all the way through the seven tracks. Carolina Beach tract is actually the tract that he left out of his will. So really the 400-acre tract and the tract that I'm referring to when it was divided is part of the Seabreeze tract.
And that was that Ellis Freeman's tract, the Seabreeze one?
Yes. Ellis was, he inherited tract six, and Ellis set aside 5 acres of the northeasternmost portion of his tract to develop Seabreeze. So all the Seabreeze just started as 5-acre tract.
In 1914 or a little later?
This was a little later, but there's also been some questions about when Seabreeze was actually known as Seabreeze, because there are previous deeds prior to 1925 and Ellis's development of it that refers to the area as Seabreeze.
But then you said the will was not clear, though. Was that on purpose?
I believe it was on purpose.
Because
he set aside tracts of land to all of his sons from his first marriage. And like I said, his wife and his children, who were still minors at that time, to share and share alike, except for 8 acres that he left specifically to Roscoe and 20 acres to Banny. And those were the coinciles that he made. And everything outside of what he, I guess, already set out in wording, like, okay, Archie, you're getting this. Robert Bruce Jr., you're getting this. Dulcie, you're getting this. Roland, you're getting this. Everybody had interest in the land outside of what he specifically gave. All the land that he did not mention and set aside specifically for one person, everybody had interest in it. Mm-hmm. So they could not get rid of it without having everybody's say-so.
Heir's property.
Yeah, heir property. And he didn't assign any of those tracts of land to any certain person because, honestly, at that time, he didn't think that they were valuable pieces of land that could be cultivated and cropped and fished. And
that's Freeman Park, too.
Yes.
But then if the family wanted to do something with that, they would have to come to consensus.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Dorian, do you want to weigh in here?
That's the problem with heir property. If I have land and I have children and I die and they have to come to an agreement that they all want to sell the property or keep the property or divide the property. And if it doesn't happen, then that's when the government comes in.
And I'm glad you kind of pointed that out because it's kind of something I've been dancing around. A large portion of the Freeman land holdings outside of the 400-acre homestead tract was seized by eminent domain. That includes Carolina Beach State Park, the 200-acre Lorraine Coast Guard Station.
Mm-hmm. On River Road.
All of that fell into the Sunny Point Military Blast Tournament. And so there was a big lawsuit, just like Snow's Cut. All of that was seized by eminent domain. The family was compensated, but not justly compensated.
When did that happen? I guess at different times.
Over the course of 30, 40 years. Well, Snow's Cut, being dredged, Coast Guard, Lorraine Station, and the Sunny Point Military Buffer Zone, and now Freeman Park.
What's your understanding of the negotiations when that happened, that Carolina Beach now owns most of Freeman Park?
Honestly, I was not involved with those negotiations. I was aware of what was going on, but since, I guess, my direct descendants, Freeman descendants, sold their interest in Freeman Park to Dr. Burnett in 1938, but I did speak with the attorneys, and essentially what I was told was the state and the county didn't want to take it via eminent domain, but if the LLCs and whoever was in charge of the LLCs not come to terms, then they were going to have to impose eminent domain. And I don't know exactly what the outcome of that was, but I know that there are still some family members that are due just compensation that have yet to receive it.
With the most recent negotiation?
This should have happened before there was any negotiation or sale finalized.
For Freeman?
For Freeman Park, yes. And, of course, the original plot maps for when they're dredging the Intracoastal Waterway of where it began and how much acreage Freeman family owned and how much they cut out and just through Snow's Cut and then going northeastwardly up towards Masonboro Island. through Myrtle Grove. Yeah, it's quite a lot, which actually shrank the 300 acres to, I believe, 270. And then it also shrank again, and I think it's 170.
And I will say that's just one part of it. You know, there are other stories of how other family members lost their land.
And that's how they view it. They lost their land, being forced to.
Being forced to, being tricked to sign paperwork, things like that.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In these instances we're talking about, or other ones too?
I don't know if it's in this time period.
It's around the same.
Yeah.
A little before or a little after. They were led to believe one thing, and I guess just...
the paperwork said something else.
Yeah.
In the 50s.
More the 1920s and early 1900s, after Robert Bruce passed. And even before Robert Bruce passed, I see some things that just don't add up.
Like you said, your family's land rich, but did they have the legal resources that they needed in order to maintain that?
I would say that's hard to answer. And the reason because I'll say it's hard to answer is because having the resources is one thing, but having someone that is willing to go to bat for you, even though you have the resources to pay them, is another thing.
And is that part of the story that students might learn?
Yeah. I mean, you can have the money to pay someone to defend your claim in court, yes. But trying to find someone that will do it in that time period, put their name on the line to say, I'm standing up for these folks of color, that would be hard to do.
Name, reputation, you know.
Yeah.
Also putting your families
at risk. Yeah.
At risk because you're standing up against the status quo.
Well, your grandfather knows all about that. So does your grandma. Your family knows a lot about that.
Yeah. And that's why it's important that we get it right, because we do have a hell of a lot to be proud of. And it's important that if, you know, we're going to tell the story, that it's told correctly.
Yeah, because it takes a lot to push, like you all said, the status quo of what is acceptable. And there are risks and rewards, but there are definitely risks.
Yeah, there are definitely risks. I mean, I was told for a long time, even growing up, that I am not to be on the other side of a snow-scut bridge after dark, or I'm not to be on River Road after dark.
Your family told you that?
Yeah.
Because of what they experienced, or what?
Because of what they experienced, because of what they were told. I mean, my mom told me stories of where she experienced racism in Carolina Beach. My mom was only 50.
We'll have to take a quick break. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith, here with Freeman descendants Christopher Eaton and Dorian Cromarty. Christopher, let's start with you. How do you learn all of this? Are you doing your own research? Are family members giving you these documents? And how are you learning your family's history?
I was fortunate enough to be raised by Miss Annetta Freeman, who was the daughter of Roland Vincent Freeman, inherited Tract 4 of the homestead, and she was a pillar of the community, the Freeman family matriarch there for a long time, and she was heavily involved in the church. So every day when I was a kid, she would pick us all up from school, and before we could do anything, it was sit on the couch, Bible study, 30 minutes of Bible study, and she would tell us stories about the Freeman family history.
And then when did you start to do your own investigations of all of these deeds and the census records?
After she passed, 2013, she was 101.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
That was right around the time my mother was getting sick, and I just kind of wanted to do something special for my mom. And so I started to put together kind of a scrapbook, all of my parents' belongings. I'm the caretaker of them, I guess. And in those possessions were all of their parents' possessions and old deeds and everything else. And when Miss Annetta Freeman passed, I was the one who had the key to her house and access to other private family documents that I didn't even know existed. When I came into possession of those, I guess, family heirlooms, it all clicked. It all made sense, except one part.
What's the part? One part?
The discovery of another Bible that dates to 1868. It was just tucked away in my great aunt's house in bubble wrap, and I took it home, studied it, and realized that there were two leaflets inside the Bible that had the Freeman family side of it, as well as Robert Bruce Freeman Sr.'s sister's side of the family and how we are connected to them. And before this, I did not know that Robert Bruce Freeman Sr. had a sister until I saw her name on the Freeman side of the family Bible page.
Okay, so we didn't know that she existed.
At least I did not know.
You did not know.
And, you know, I looked her up. I was able to find some census records and her death certificate. And I don't know if I should backtrack or if I should just keep rolling with it, but after Alexander's death prior to 1860, Charity kind of disappears from the census record in New Hanover County. She reappears in downtown Wilmington, but she is a member of the household of Jane Green. And I always thought that that was strange. And so I looked into who Jane Green was, which is where I found the death certificate for Jane Green. And it lists on her death certificate who her parents were, and it says Alex and Charity Freeman. I think after Alexander passed, I think she might have chosen to go live with her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though she was the wife of Alexander, women at that time could not hold property, especially if there was a living heir and son. And since Alexander left a will leaving everything to Robert Bruce, she was kind of disinherited from anything. Alexander did not mention Charity in his will at all.
And it's what with the land, because he couldn't, or he could have, or we don't know.
Could have, but for some reason he, I guess, had that much trust and faith in his son that he would
take care of her.
Take care of her. And what the relationship between Jane Green and Robert Bruce Freeman was, I can only speculate, but I do know that they were not estranged.
Dorian, when did you start learning? Because technically you all are cousins, correct? Yeah.
So I started learning about it when I got out the military and there was a gravesite cleanup at the old cemetery that Chris had organized. I had first learned about it when I was like 8 or 9 years old and my granddad brought me back to the old cemetery, but I just didn't know where I was and how it was important, and it was all grown over.
Was it with starting with Alexander and Charity Freeman and those properties in Seabreeze, or which part of?
Let's see. The most I've ever known about Robert Bruce Freeman was that he had all this land growing up. That's the most I ever knew. And I didn't grow up here like Chris did. So I did high school and stuff in Atlanta, and I came down here for the summers, and that was the most I ever knew about Robert Bruce Freeman. And then as I got to know Chris and the rest of my family after I moved back here, that's when I discovered everything else.
It's just amazing that he had the capabilities to do that. And, I mean, do we know, were there bidding wars for the land? Or it's like nobody really wanted it, so he came along and...
Well, he bought them at auction, so I don't believe there was
high demand
for the land. From what I have learned was that he purchased failing plantations. That's where you get the names like Gander Hall Plantation and Sedgley Abbey Plantation. He purchased Gander Hall and what was left of Sedgley Abbey Plantation.
And do we know if he faced any discrimination or pushback because of who he was in buying all this? Or do we have any inkling about that climate at the time?
In 1876, during Reconstruction, I don't think he would have. And he paid cash for it.
Not asking questions.
Yeah. I don't believe so. And from just, I guess, oral history and from what I've been told, he was a rather intimidating person. He was quite tall, imposing.
Do we know how tall he was?
I do not.
Like 6
There's
feet, maybe?
Not
yeah.
even
we
a
don't know.
Known picture of him.
Really? There's no known picture of
that
him.
That still exists.
That still exists.
I do have a picture of Charity, or who I believe is Charity. It's a daguerreotype, 1850s. It's not in the best shape, but it's one of the items that I fell into possession with. When I found the Bible, I also found that. And just my reasoning, who else would be that age in 1850, and why would my great aunt have this picture locked in her safe?
So it's likely her.
More than likely is.
What does she look like?
Native American woman. You're definitely a woman of Native American descent.
The start of Seabreeze, tell us that story and when it started becoming a hub.
According to all the documents, the earliest known plat of Ellis's development in Seabreeze dated to 1924. And that is for the 5 acres that he set aside. Now, who helped him develop that? There is speculation that some of the other brothers formed a company that assisted him, but I don't have any proof of that. But I do know that it was Ellis who spearheaded it.
The building of Seabreeze.
The building of it and the development of it, because it's on his tract. I do believe his older brother, John Nathan Freeman, who owned Tract 5 right above him, also invested with his brother because of some of what we know now as Seabreeze does fall into his tract as well. And I don't see any documentation of where Ellis or anybody else purchased that land from John Nathan. But then again, John Nathan moved to Philadelphia sometime in between 1915 and 1934.
And that's when it started picking up, right? The 1930s is when Seabreeze was becoming a really big attraction. Can you describe what it was and why people wanted to come there?
It was a place for African Americans during Jim Crow era to escape and go and have fun and just kind of be free of all segregation and just escape from it all and dance and sing. And they had bands and, you know, attractions down there, and they could go fishing, they could go swimming, you know, a lot of recreational things.
In Rebecca Taylor's presentation, she was saying that World War II as well, they hosted a lot of black servicemen because it was one of the only places that would allow them to come and stay before they went across the Atlantic.
Yes.
Did it kind of dissipate in the 1960s when integration efforts were picking up, or what's your understanding of how it ended its heyday, I guess?
I'm sure integration might have had some role in it, but I don't believe that's the primary role. I believe a lot of the destruction from Hurricane Diane and Hurricane Hazel had a lot to do with that, and just trying to rebuild and then a few years later having to rebuild it all again. I think they were running low on resources, so it was just more of passing along what they still owned to their descendants, and their descendants either selling their interests to whoever. And I think that was kind of the slow downfall of what I guess my mom and a lot of people that came before me would call Seabreeze, because the area has changed a lot since I was going down there in 93 and spending summers down there with my great aunt and, you know, going to Snow's Cut and being taught how to crab fish with nothing but a string and a chicken bone. It's changed tremendously since 1998 to what it is now. It's not the same, but also understand that, you know, change is inevitable.
Did they still own some of that land where you went fishing when you were a kid?
Not anymore.
So you would go and visit your families,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, when you were fishing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When did they start selling some of their property?
believe it was the early 2000s, the developers moved in. And of course, I was a child. I had no say in the matter. I can't tell my mom what to do or my great aunt what to do with what is rightfully theirs. And so I believe they did what was best and sold a majority of what they had left to the developers. But of course, they kept certain tracks for themselves.
Going back to this board presentation, I mean, when you were watching it, you and Christopher, the way it's being presented, how did you view that? And would you make any changes? Because they're providing the groundwork for this to be in the curriculum for New Hanover students.
Being that this is history, and it is essentially going to be in someone else's hands to write it, I want to get every single detail we can get it right. And we have a lot to be proud of. And I want to make sure that everything we have to be proud of is presented right and truthfully, and that it doesn't get rewritten or watered down to something that it's not. Because when I look at what we have to be proud of, it's something that if it didn't happen, maybe these parts of this county wouldn't be here.
You have something to follow up on that, Christopher?
No, I disagree with him.
Did you want to come to that presentation? Or
did I want to come to the presentation? Or no, but I would have wanted someone there while they are presenting. Or at least, hey, you know, we're going to put on this presentation. Do you want to do some fact checking?
It was a great gesture. It's just the way that it
was done.
It could have been done differently.
Mm-hmm.
Differently as in some of the things that we hit on? Or is there something specific?
Could have notified the family
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, this is what we're planning on doing.
Mm-hmm. It's supposed to go through committee first. And so, you know, when you were like, oh, this is at a meeting for a presentation, I'm like, how? This is not a curriculum committee meeting.
Mm-hmm. And what facts are important to you?
The names are important and the whys in the stories are important. Why was Seabreeze created? Why was this paradise away from segregation created, discrimination? Why was this happening? Why is it that Robert Bruce Freeman was able to work with white people during this era? Why is that? Why didn't the events of 1898 affect the Freeman family? It's a good story, yes. The facts are important, but the why and the how it happened is also important. And we can't just say that it's just a good story and it's happenstance, but these set of people, yeah, they were free, but it's still something to see you as a person of color or a Native American person and have so much even now and see someone else that looks like you and don't have much. So you still have those things as a person of color you struggle with even if you have so much, because even then you were held to a different standard. And it may not have been said because you were a business owner or you were a landowner, but at the end of the day, we know as people of color that when we go home and we look in the mirror, no matter what we have, we're a person of color. And we are held to a different standard. And so I can see where you have so much going on back then, and you are a property owner, but to see your fellow man who don't have as much struggle, and knowing that you could help this person, but you also could risk losing your life helping this person because this white person may not agree. There was racism, but there was also, colorism, too.
At HQR, we've done work on 1898 and the prospering Black community that we had prior to that, that was very strong, that operated. And of course, there was racism. And they're, like you said, they still were held to a different standard, but they were serving in government. They were firefighters. It looked like Robert Bruce served on a jury. They were integrated and trusted as parts of society. But then post 1898, what does that look like? And I mean, how did Robert Bruce operate pre and post? Do we know?
Well, Robert Bruce, seeing as that he passed away December of 1901, I do know that he was still living in the Myrtle Grove Sound area, somewhere in the homestead, the 400 acres. Since he did have these relationships with these white gentlemen, my grandfather, Alphonse Freeman, was born in the early days of October 1898. So he would have been maybe a month, couple weeks old. in November 1898, and he's fine. Then on the opposite side of that, Alphonse's wife, Augusta Davis Freeman, her father is listed in the Senate report as being one of the people who was shot, but he recovered. And from, again, this is all just story passed down from what I'm hearing from my dad and my mom and from my grandparents, was that he was working at a restaurant on 2nd Street. And he was, I'm not sure what he was doing, but he was minding his own business and just all of a sudden just got shot in the back. Could have been a ricochet, could have just been a stray bullet. But he is listed in the Senate report as Henry Davis. But there's, I think there were 3 or 4 Henry Davises listed in Wilmington at that time. But that story I was told after I read the Senate report. So it was like, really? Okay. Well, that does make sense. I've asked other family members about this and, you know, they said, yes, it's true.
And going back to what Dorian said, that question, I mean, do we know the facts about how Robert Bruce was allowed to, I mean, it was a multicultural world that he was operating in before his children were in the Jim Crow world. But still, I mean, like you said, a person of color still was looked at a certain way. But why do you think, because Robert Bruce had so much land and commercial power that, and then he had a personality too, combined with those other factors. Do you think that's why?
I think he was highly respected. I do know that there are newspaper articles referring to him as Chief Justice Freeman. I know that Archie and Robert Bruce were, specifically Archie, his firstborn son, was a justice of the peace for Federal Point Township during Reconstruction.
And we need to take a quick break. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith. It's a conversation with Freeman descendants Christopher Eaton and Dorian Cromartie. So Dorian, when Pat Bradford, who's a board member, when she said she wanted the incredible and wonderful story of the entrepreneurial Freeman family to be told, I mean, is there more to that? I mean, is that a good encapsulation of your family story?
No, I mean, it's a lot more than that.
Yeah,
right?
It's just one.
One piece.
Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult because she was with the other board members who will be in power for 2 more years. I mean, they banned the book, as you know. It took about 9 months to do, with stamped racism, anti-racism in you. And again, that was about the history of America written by 2 black authors and up to the present point. And it was a perspective, and that was banned. And it's just interesting that this person is now bringing your family's history into the curriculum. And what is that going to look like knowing that move?
I think that the goal of wanting this to be in the curriculum is a good goal. I do. I think that if it's going to be told, it should be told correctly. You know, especially given the fact that a lot of times we see in schools a great program or teaching start somewhere and then it goes across the state. So especially if it has that potential to do that, it should be told correctly. It is strange that the story is wanted to be told in this specific era where they are having these book bannings and things like that. It is strange. I think sometimes with these stories, especially when you have to talk about family history, a lot of times the perspective that a person can hear is different from the perspective that is what is being told. And some may hear the story of the Freeman family or of Seabreeze and think, oh, this is a group of people or a family that overcame adversity with ease due to this, that, and the third. But if you were to tell the true story of the whole Seabreeze family history, there is adversity, there is racism, there is discrimination. There is more than just being entrepreneurs. There's more than just being landowners or fishermen or farmers. Or it's a lot more than that. And it's a lot more complicated than people tend to think. It's deep. It goes deep.
I mean, kind of the way that the story is told is that the Freemans were the exception and that they were different and they were able to succeed and maybe others weren't. Is that fair?
Back then, if you were lighter skin tone, you got a different standard. If you were a darker skin tone, you got a different standard. And being Robert Bruce's skin tone and his family's skin tone at that time, in that place, with his swagger of doing things, some things were easier than it would be for me, of my skin tone. So it is important that if we're going to tell the story of how this happened, tell those little whys as to why it was able to happen. I mean, we got family members that could tell us that they were treated differently than their brothers or sisters because of their skin tone. One sibling being lighter than the other and going into a place and getting treated differently. So it's a lot of that in there too.
Well, Christopher, was Robert Bruce light-skinned? Is that right?
That is what has been passed down through oral history, yes, because of the complexion of his sons. I know what Roland looked like. I know what his brother, John Nathan, looked like. Ellis and everybody preceding him to Archie, they were from one marriage, his first marriage, to Catherine Ann Davis Freeman. And they were also of lighter skin complexion. After Catherine Davis passed away in 1885, Robert Bruce Freeman Sr. married his second wife, who was very young, and she was of darker complexion. And all the descendants from that marriage tend to be of darker complexion.
It was a thing back in the day where you got you a Freeman man. He was known as being tall and light-skinned.
And I mean, that land and that commercial power, I mean, that speaks volume, and it speaks volumes today, too.
I guess just to touch on that kind of subject, going back to the temperament of after 1898 and after the brothers sold or gave the option to the developers to develop Carolina Beach, as soon as those agreements went through, they immediately banned any sale or anybody of African American descent, mulatto descent, Native American descent could not buy, rent, or even mortgage land on Carolina Beach. That was added as a restrictive covenant into the deeds in the 1920s. Probably before that, the Freemans couldn't even cross over into Carolina Beach to get to their own property. But Freeman Beach and Freeman Park, you would have to travel onto Carolina Beach to access it by automobile, and they couldn't do it.
They couldn't do it.
No, they had to cross the Sound.
And then they were allowed to be there then because it was Freeman land, right?
Yeah. Yes. I brought this up to my father, and I was like, this doesn't seem right at all. And from what my father told me is that was actually a common thing during Jim Crow to put into deeds. But I just thought it was kind of, it didn't sit right with me when I read that. Wow, really?
Yeah, what else of this history is really important for you all, for students to know?
Why was Seabreeze like our Myrtle Beach? Why did all these famous people that came and performed in Wilmington, why did they have to sleep in Seabreeze? There are parts of it that need to be mentioned that are ugly parts of history, but it's the truth. And some people, well, you know, people today would find it crazy if, like, Snoop Dogg came and performed in Wilmington and he couldn't stay downtown at the hotel and then he had to go stay in Seabreeze. Like, people wouldn't go for that. Performers back then, that's what they had to do.
It's interesting because when you talk about Seabreeze and some of your other family's properties, it became a place where, did you feel like it was a place where people felt safe and they could have fun and not have to, but then there was this larger world out there that was not very supportive of them.
I mean, growing up there, for me, I always felt safe in Seabreeze. This was in the 90s, before where on the service road, you couldn't see anything back in Seabreeze. You just know that there's a store on the corner, and that's it. It's all just trees. Like, this was before all of the beach houses that are there. I could go down there, and no matter where I went in Seabreeze, somebody knew my parents or my grandparents. It wasn't no, who are you? It wasn't no, what are you doing here? It's, oh, that's Missy's son. Oh, that's Billy's grandson. Oh, that's him and his cousins. You know, they're walking in the woods. They got the gun. You know, they're riding the lawnmower. They're riding the go-kart. That's what it was. It was no paved roads, you know, except for the one road. But, you know, I took a dirt road to Granddaddy's house, and now there's a paved road there.
That was what it was like as a kid when mm-hmm. you visited in the summers.
Yeah. I could go from, on low tide, I could go from the, from Snow's Cut and walk all the way down to Seabreeze and catch crabs and fish and walk in and out of the woods, and you can't do that no more. It's really sad to see. You go fishing down there, someone thinks you're on their property, they'll call the cops on you. It's no real sense of community like it used to be, and that's what I miss the most. I'd never had a babysitter in Seabreeze. Like, never. It was, if I started at my granddad's house and I went down to the water, on the way there or back, I would see like four or five different relatives and check in with them to see how they're doing. And then go do my business on the water and go back to the house and wave at them on the way back. And say I did, on the way back, take a detour and go in the woods. My aunts or uncles or cousins seen me, and, or they done said, hey, I seen, you know, the boys, and they walked into the woods and they should be out shortly, but it's not like that no more.
And excuse my ignorance too, what, like, what's on the property now that constitutes what you're describing?
I mean, now, you know, you go down to the water, you got the jet ski rental, you have beach houses and boats everywhere. Granted, coming up, it was a couple of beach houses, you know, but there were beach houses of people you knew. It was beach houses of people that would wave and talk to you. It was, if you didn't know them, someone knew them.
Do any of your family still have the homes right there or no?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some still there.
Yeah, there's some still there.
I'm really glad that you pointed that out about, you know, sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
Is Seabreeze is more than just about the Freeman family. I really want to make that clear. It's more than just the Freemans. There are so many families that have been down there since the same amount of time that the Freemans have, and they've withstood the same adversities.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have family reunions out there?
We need a good, far-reaching family reunion. Our family's so large. Like Chris said earlier, it's not just the Freeman family. It's like the Atwoods, the McNeils, the Rosses, the Blackledges. I mean, it goes on and on and on. The Green, you know, it's a long list of families that are down there in Seabreeze.
Yeah, I mean, Robert Bruce had, what, 11 kids?
And some of those kids had even more kids, so.
Mm-hmm.
It's a community of everybody that lived in the area, took care of one another, went to church at Mount Pilgrim, which Mount Pilgrim Missionary Baptist Church, that was built on land donated by Archie Freeman, one of the original brothers. But the community came together and built that church, different families.
Mm-hmm.
And my great aunt left a note tucked in her Bible pretty much explaining the history of how that church came to be.
And when was that church built?
It was built a little before 1911.
It's the oldest church in that area.
And it has been moved quite a few times. Well, the main one that I know of is when they turned Caroline Beach Road from a two-lane highway to a four-lane highway.
Do you have similar stories like that as a kid, just running down there and seeing everybody? And
being the youngest of three, I was kind of like the scapegoat a little bit. But yeah, me and my brother, we'd, you know, walk out the back door to my great aunt's house and walk through the woods and end up at my grandparents' house. But we would always go there and get in, and my great aunt, she'd be calling around neighbors, oh, have you seen him? Have you seen him? And, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, it's okay. And she'd come get us. Or
It was the only place in Wilmington I could go outside and be outside after dark.
Yeah.
Like, if the street lights came on in Wilmington, I had to go inside. But if I was in Seabreeze, I could stay outside. And there were no street lights down there.
Yeah, I know.
Well, thank you guys for joining me.
Well, thank you for
having us.
Thanks to guests Dorian Cromarty and Christopher Eaton, and to WHQR's Ken Campbell for technical support. If you missed any part of this program, you can find it at whqr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Keith. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.